You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, from the CIA's hacking scandal to Nicolas Sarkozy's phone-tapping intrigue, Xenia Dormady and Gavin McFadyen will join me to discuss the biggest stories of the day. As the protests in Venezuela enter their second month, we take a look at the way the country's famously polarised television is covering the crisis. Chavez may be long gone, but he still lives on screen.
Aló, presidente, bravo, el aló, presidente, el jueves por la noche.
Then to another president on TV. Barack Obama does comedy to promote healthcare.
So how does this work? Do you send Ambassador Rodman to North Korea on your behalf? I read somewhere that you'd be sending Hulk Hogan to Syria.
We'll assess if Zach Galifianakis's show Between Two Ferns is really the best tool to promote Obamacare. We'll also be in Alabama and play some new music. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. But before all that, here's David Spencer with the latest news headlines for around the world.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. There's been more confusion over the possible last movements of the Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777 that disappeared last weekend. The Malaysian military now says that a plane that could have been flight MH370 was traced by the Air Force to south of the Thai holiday resort of Phuket. It had previously backtracked on claims a plane had been spotted by its radar. Meanwhile, the last message received from the plane suggests everything was normal on board at the time. The search has been significantly expanded today. Malaysia's Transport Minister, Hishamuddin Hussein, gave details at a news conference earlier.
The search has been expanded to two areas, and we are now searching nearly 27,000 square nautical miles. 42 ships and 39 aircraft have now been deployed to search for MH370. 12 countries have joined the search, with India, Japan and Brunei being the latest to join in.
Turkish police have fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse a crowd of several thousand demonstrators in Ankara in a protest triggered by the death of a teenager wounded in street clashes last summer. Berkin Elvan died on Tuesday, 9 months after he was injured during street battles in Istanbul between police and protesters. The 15-year-old had been in a coma ever since and became a rallying point for government opponents. In Istanbul, tens of thousands of mourners marched through the streets chanting anti-government slogans as the teenager's funeral took place. US Secretary of State John Kerry is to travel to London to meet his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov to discuss the crisis in Ukraine. The talks on Friday will attempt to ease tensions ahead of a referendum in Crimea on Sunday.
I will make clear again, as I have throughout this crisis, that while we respect, obviously, that Russia has deep historical, cultural, and other kinds of interests with respect to Ukraine and particularly Crimea, nothing justifies a military intervention that the world has witnessed.
Meanwhile, leaders of the G7 group of nations have called on Russia to stop all efforts to what a statement described as annex Ukraine's Crimea region. They said if Russia took such a step, they would take further action individually and collectively. Two buildings have collapsed in New York City, killing at least two people and injuring at least 18. A search of the rubble of the buildings in Upper Manhattan is underway in case anyone is trapped. Residents said there was a loud boom that could be heard several streets away. There have been reports of a gas leak before the collapse. Italy's lower house of parliament has approved a new electoral law aimed at ensuring more stable governments. The vote is a boost to Prime Minister Matteo Renzi as he prepares to unveil a package of tax cuts and economic reforms. The measures are expected to include €10 billion in income tax cuts for low earners and more flexible employment rules to boost job creation. Authorities in Burundi have ordered the arrest of an opposition leader after clashes between his party members and police. More than a dozen members of the opposition Movement for Solidarity and Democracy Party were injured in the clashes that took place on Saturday. The East African nation is facing its worst political crisis since emerging from a 12-year civil war in 2005. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
David Spencer, thank you very much indeed. It's just come up to 18:06 here in London, 14:06 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Certainly is Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Joining me now for a look back at the biggest stories of the day is Xenia Dormandy, Project Director for the US at the think tank Chatham House, and Gavin McFadyen, Director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism. Welcome both of you to the programme. We're going to start in the US. Senator Dianne Feinstein, the head of the US Senate Intelligence Committee, has publicly accused the CIA of improperly accessing computers used by congressional staff. It sounds small bore, but it's actually potentially incredibly serious, Xenia Dormandy, isn't it?
It is incredibly serious. I mean, what is so interesting about this and really should tell you everything is Dianne Feinstein has been a strong supporter of the CIA, has worked very, very effectively with them to carry their message to the Senate, to carry their message through the system. If she's actually having to come out publicly, what that tells you is that the CIA has not responded to any of her concerns or her queries, and there is potentially a huge bust-up. Now, how that will be dealt with, what we've seen is the CIA Director John Brennan say, we don't need to apologize. When you get the information, you will understand why not. It was all kind of kosher and perfectly legitimate. But the fact that they weren't able to answer her queries that were made twice in January tells you just how seriously she's taking it, and more broadly, the Justice Department will take it.
Gavin McFadyen, before I bring you in, I just want to play you a few words from Sasha Reisenberger, Washington correspondent, who we spoke to a little bit earlier on the briefing, on just that point that Xenia raised there about the fact that it was Dianne Feinstein who was saying this.
I mean, I guess we don't know how rare it would be for the intelligence community to be monitoring Capitol Hill, but everybody is pretending as though this is something that is pretty shocking, and it's, you know, Dianne Feinstein made this very publicly. It was like a 45-minute speech yesterday on the floor of the Senate, televised. And what's remarkable is that she, as chair of the committee, has been the sort of loudest defender of the intelligence community, particularly on the sort of Snowden-related leaks. She's been sort of seen as a very centrist, hawkish figure within the Democratic Party.
Sasha Reisenberg there, a little earlier, speaking to us on the briefing. Gavin McFadyen, this is essentially the establishment versus the establishment.
Exactly, if you can call it that. I think the difficulty is that the actual charge, which listeners may not be entirely familiar with, is that the CIA was taken 700 documents that were the property of the committee as evidence to the committee of torture and mistreatment of prisoners and all the rest, and they disappeared them. At the same time, as there were serious allegations by people very close to the CIA that they were spying on committee members and spying on committee processes. So
now were they allegedly spying on the committee members? That word allegedly, spying on the committee members because this committee was investigating what they'd been up to.
Exactly. In other words, the idea was clearly, as so often happens when you're dealing with spooks in this kind of world, is that their primary obligation is to prevent embarrassment. And that means often getting rid of uncomfortable facts, difficult documents, bad testimony, disappeared videotapes, like we've seen with all the interrogations.
I mean, so arguably, they would say their primary motive isn't disappearing things. It's about, you know, keeping America safe.
Well, they always would say that. I mean, any government will say that about its own behavior, no matter how awful it is.
Yes.
I mean, the difficulty is that we've spent, myself and my colleagues here in The Guardian and others have spent months going over much of this material. And the most awful of that material, the most damaging, the most frightening in a way, in terms of the extent of the spying, has never even been before that committee. That's yet to come. Of all the Snowden documents that deal in this area, only 6% have been in the public, and they're dribbling out in a very effective way.
Zanya Dumadi, when we look at what this could mean in the long term, in terms of the way that this system is supposed to work in America, there is supposed to be democratic oversight of the CIA, of the FBI, of all the different agencies. And it's that its suggestion that might have broken down, which is the fundamental problem.
Exactly. You've put your finger exactly on it, which is the idea of oversight. That the way that the American system works, like so many others, is that you have an oversight mechanism to the institutions. So the administration, the departments can't just go down a road and do what they want without any fear of somebody kind of occasionally, you know, pulling them back up and saying, oi, wait a sec, that's not what we agreed to. If you've got the institution that is being overseen, then overseeing the overseers, if you can follow that logic, you have a real problem. And so the objection actually that Dianne Feinstein has put forward is that the committee, of which she is the head, found information that they weren't supposed to have access to. And the CIA was trying to, and this is what the story says, the CIA was trying to understand how they gained access to that information. And I think what you're seeing is that the committee say, well, the fact remains we had access to it, so you shouldn't have to look into how we got access to it. We did have access to it. Now you have to answer the questions associated with that. That is what oversight's about.
In other words, the issue is whether you've done something wrong, not how we know whether you've done something wrong.
Exactly.
Gavin McFadyen, put yourself in Barack Obama's shoes for a moment.
A very difficult
idea. No, look, I'm sure you can do it. I have faith in you. The CIA director, John Brennan, mm-hmm. is your former counterterrorism advisor. Mm-hmm. You've just appointed him to mm-hmm. become director of the CIA, mm-hmm. and yet you are a Democrat with both a small D and a big D. You want there to be democratic oversight. Dianne Feinstein is an ally of yours on a number of issues. How do you deal with this?
I think the first issue is that who deals with whom? I'm not at all convinced that Barack Obama, for all his strengths and weaknesses, is an entirely independent creature of Mr. Brennan and all of his associates. I mean, what we've seen is that the increasing and graduating power of the security establishment, aided by their military friends and the corporate establishment behind them, is so huge. With such, for example, it in itself constitutes.
Let's just assume that Barack Obama is, has all his faculties and is able to make a decision on his own.
It's not a question, I think, of him having all his faculties or being a nice guy or a bad guy. The issue for Barack Obama is, to whom is he independent? And I'm not at all clear that he's independent of those people because he's never taken a real meaningful stand against them.
Wait a sec. I mean, this idea of independence, you wouldn't want independence. I mean, the people who are good at their jobs are the ones who take information. Let's forget Obama and whether we like or we dislike Obama for 1 second. But they're the people who take information from all the source, they take experts, and they make some kind of a decision based on the information and analysis that they have available to them. So the idea that anybody is independent from the sources of information from which they gather their decision-making processes is fundamentally a false one. Now, we can argue whether the security establishment has too much access to Obama compared to, say, the diplomats or the journalists or the other authorities. But the idea that anybody is going to have independence, I think, is fundamentally a false one.
Before this runs away from us, very, very, very quickly, Zanya, I just want to bring it back to the
CIA.
What it is that the Senate committee is actually supposedly looking at. Now, this is about stuff that actually happened during the Bush administration. So if you were George W. Bush or Dick Cheney or someone connected to that administration, would you be feeling a little bit sort of wary about what might be revealed now?
I think there's a lot of wariness in the CIA at the moment, and it's partly due to the revelations of Snowden. It's partly due to, you know, all sorts of pieces of information. You know, a lot of the stories now are re-churning, you know, was the alleged torture, if we're going to keep using the word alleged here, alleged torture, you know, was it successful?
We can call it torture.
You know, was the torture actually an effective intelligence process during the Bush administration? I mean, there's all sorts of discomfort, but these are going to get churned up again and again and again without any good answers. The one that the real question that is ultimately incredibly important and we need to focus on, in my view, is if you have democratic oversight of an institution, can you have democratic oversight of an institution if you have the people who are being checking the oversight? And the answer almost certainly is no, and Dianne Feinstein is therefore right to bring this up.
We'll leave it on that note because I want to turn to another subject. We've got three more subjects to fit in before the half hour. We're going to stay in DC, though, for our next story. Ukraine's interim Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk is meeting Barack Obama today, the US president's latest demonstration of support for the government in Kiev. And the visit highlights that Ukraine has become something of a test case for American power and how foreign policy is changing at the moment. Gavin, if I can begin with you, the fact that Barack Obama is inviting the interim prime minister in Ukraine to Washington, does that to you suggest that actually all he's really got at the moment are symbols that he can make, that actually to actually do things that make a difference on the ground, he doesn't have many tools at his disposal?
I think the tools he often has are embarrassing and difficult. I think you're right, though. It's a correct characterization. Up to now, it's been a kind of weird proxy war. And I'm not sure who the other side really was. We all thought it was the Russians. That appears not to be entirely the case. A lot of the opposition that was being heralded in Washington turns out to be neo-Nazis and anti-Semites of a whole variety of
kinds. A small part, yeah.
A small part, but very powerful. They are the armed group that runs four government ministries. That's a very powerful thing. And that's not small. It's not marginal. In other words, it's much bigger than Hitler had in 1924.
I think let's try and leave the Nazi.
Except we're talking about Nazis. We're not talking about glorious democratic figures on the democratic left in Europe. You're talking about really unpleasant neo-fascist elements who have now taken partial control of a government. And that this is increasingly coming to fore in Washington. People are beginning to understand that. I mean, here at MAPS, perhaps it may not have reached the same crescendo of indifference as it has in most places, but it's still quite serious.
Zanya Dormandy, that nuance that has sort of developed over the past few weeks, is that do you share that view?
Are there some nasty people along with the nice people? Yes. Is that true in the UK? Yes. Is that true in the US? Absolutely. I think it is naive to expect only the right people and the good people and the people with the white cloaks behind them to lead. I think that the point that one needs to focus on, and this is, there are two parts. One is, the point that needs to focus on is it legitimate, and I use that word carefully, to use force, military force, kinetic force, to affect change in another country's rights without actually asking them about their rights? No, the US doesn't actually, the West doesn't want to use force in Ukraine. Their position is this should be the choice of the Ukrainians. And that's where I think there is a very clear right and wrong on this, to the extent that anything is ever clear. The point that you started with, which is this a sign of perhaps diminished power? I think it's interesting. We berate the Americans for using too much military force, and then we berate the Americans for not using enough military force. The question is the use of the military, the use of economic, the use of diplomatic levers. The West has reverted to diplomatic and economic levers. The Russians have reverted to military. The military is a short-term lever. Diplomatic and economic are longer-term levers. So how that's going to play out, I think, is an interesting one, but doesn't necessarily indicate lack of influence or lack of power.
And Gavin, here in Europe, you know, Germany has its gas deals with Russia, France has its arms deals with Russia. Here in Britain, we have a lot of Russian money. We're not entirely sure where it's all come from, swishing around the city of London. Do you get any inkling that any of the great powers in Europe feel like taking a little bit of a hit for their principles?
No, I don't think so. I think that there was a big article in the press this morning here in London about the Russians being tendering for a British nuclear fuel deal, which is an astonishing notion that the technology that produced the largest catastrophe in atomic history is now being invited to return to Britain to tender in a country which had, traditionally has had a very safe view of it. But I think just on a previous comment, I think the difficulty with some of that is that the whole dispute and fight that occurred in the country we're talking about was often armed and financed and paid for by Americans. And that's a pretty problematic issue.
It's
like the Purple Revolution, the Red Revolution, the Green Revolution, all of these things. I see you shaking your heads in denial.
Everyone in the room is shaking their heads. We're not going to get into that now because I want to get on to a couple of other things. We're going to leave that there with a comment and a head shake. You're listening to Midori House. We're back to talk about France. And a lighter side to President Barack Obama after this.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight.
For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
For Monocle in Jordan, I'm Nigel Wilson.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Accra, I'm Jocelyn Edwards.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv, I'm Marika Peters.
From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Megan Dietry.
For Monocle in Igualada, I'm Lee Mulders.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're back with Midori House. A little calmer here in Studio One. Although, you never know, we might ratchet this up a little bit again now. I'm with Gavin McFadyen and Zania Dormandy. We're going to talk about Obama in a moment. Obama the stand-up. But first, it's been rather a good week for hacking scandals, it seems. And France's former president, Nicolas Sarkozy, knows that very well. Recent revelations about investigators tapping the former president's phone after allegations that Muammar Gaddafi, indeed his son, had allegedly funded his presidential election back in 2007, has been making news in France and beyond. Yesterday, François Hollande's government acknowledged that it knew about the surveillance. Gavin, we've had in recent weeks, obviously we all know about the NSA hacking with Angela Merkel's phone, but there's also been a couple of rather high quality recordings of diplomats in Europe. The most recent, of course, was Cathy Ashton, the European Union's foreign policy chief, talking to the Estonian foreign minister. And now we have this surveillance of Nicolas Sarkozy. Is this a good thing? Do everyone just sort of accept that everyone is spying on each other?
Well, that seems to be the common assumption, that all leaders are entitled in one form or another. This was certainly the American view, that in the WikiLeaks cables, that it was just common practice and therefore why should anybody be excited about it? But I think it raises real issues of preeminence and power. It means that the most powerful countries, United States in particular, or Russia or China, can do pretty much what they will. And nobody should really be too excited about it. I think Sarkozy himself admitted at one point that they had spied on every passenger in Air France first class, which I thought was an astonishing notion.
It would be fascinating to listen to that, wouldn't it?
It'd probably actually be very boring.
Very boring. That's my thought exactly. But nonetheless, I think it's such a common currency now that despite the protestations of Angela Merkel and Sarkozy, I think it's very, very commonplace.
And Zania, I guess in a way, if in this specific case with Sarkozy, if actually investigators in France use phone tapping against criminals or alleged criminals than the fact that they use it against former presidents shows that they're willing to treat everyone just the same.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. My understanding of this is it isn't actually hacking in the traditional sense that we think of it. It's phone tapping. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the government phone tapping an individual who they believe has done something illegal. Although it doesn't actually say quite what illegal it was. No. That was done, you know. Other, I don't know whether funding from Libya is illegal, but nevertheless, why should a former leader be treated any differently from the public? And if you think of it in those terms, this is the government trying to find information about what is potentially illegal activity. You know what? That fair dues, really.
Fair enough. Okay, before we go, I want to discuss Barack Obama's most recent press appearance. He was interviewed, it was a kind of an interview, by Zach Galifianakis. Yes, the guy with the beard from The Hangover, on his spoof celebrity interview show Between Two Ferns. Rather interesting one-on-one, to say the least. Let's have a little listen before we talk about it.
I have to know, what is it like to be the last black president?
Seriously? What's it like for this to be the last time you ever talk to a president?
It must kind of stink, though, that you can't run, you know, three times.
No, actually, I think it's a good idea. You know, if I ran a third time, it'd be sort of like doing a third Hangover movie. Didn't really work out very well, did it?
The thing I love about this is actually the bits that we can't really play because they're just silences where the two of them look at each other. Zany, he was on there to promote healthcare.gov. It seems to have worked rather well, hasn't it?
It does. It does seem to have worked. I mean, you know, the episode, the YouTube episode got, I think, within 2 days or 6 million hits. The
several thousand of those are people here in the office watching it again and again and again.
It wasn't that funny. You guys need to do more. You have too much time in your hands, is what I'm trying to say.
I'm
failing dismally. You need to get out more. Thank you,
fine,
Gavin.
Thanks.
I'm now going to be chucked off too. No, I mean, I think it's actually really interesting that, you know, the reality is that you've got audiences that are much more diverse now. And so actually you can't just go on CNN and get your message out. You can't just go on the BBC and get your message out. You actually have to try different things. You know, one of the questions that the White House was asked is, you know, is this below Obama's dignity? No, this is getting out your message.
But there is that question, Gavin, isn't there, of, you know, should a president be doing this? I mean, you know, we see it in this country whenever a prime minister chooses to sit on the sofa of This Morning or one of the daytime shows rather than be interviewed by a proper interviewer. There will be some people in the country who will look at this and go, this isn't what a president should be doing.
Well, I think Bill Clinton did it. Others have done it in the past. I don't think Nixon had a kindly view of producing comedy programs. But I think, on the other hand, there's nothing wrong with talking to an audience if you have something to say. I think what's extraordinary about this piece of television comedy was how little was actually said. It was mostly jokey stuff. And the idea that 6 million people may have looked in on it at some point in an interview is a tiny number in a society of 300 million, where 27 million people might even go to a news program. So 6 million is actually quite small. I would think, in fact, despite what they say, that it's actually a bit of an embarrassment.
Really?
Yep.
Okay. Zany, on this, when we look at this, you know, 6 million, whether we think that's a high number.
Well, it was 6 million of the audience that he wanted to hit, who he needed to get signed up to healthcare.com, to healthcare.gov. So, I mean, yes, 6 million, small number, but it was absolutely targeting the audience he really needed to target in a way that he wouldn't have been able to do another way.
Now, the thing that was often mentioned about George W. Bush and presidents generally was that we want someone who you can imagine having a beer with. The irony, of course, with Bush being that he didn't drink anymore. But still, with Obama, is he actually sort of showing a side that for, you know, for some voters, it's not about I want to have a beer with this guy, but I could sit down and I could invite him around for dinner. He seems like the sort of person that would actually be quite nice to chat to.
So here's the problem. You've got a vastly more diversified audience than you ever did in the past in terms of people you want to talk to, people you want to engage with, which means that you need diversification of your message. So this is one way of diversifying your message. The trouble is you can't be all things to all people. So the minute you diversify to appeal to a youthful audience, you're going to have people who sit at the other extreme perhaps say, oh, you know, bad that our president is doing this. The young may want to sit and have a beer with him, but others won't. And so, I mean, the problem is what they're trying to do is appeal to all people at all times, and you cannot do that. At some point, you do actually need to make choices. And the question is, are they making those choices, or are they going to be fit in certain directions?
I mean, I think the problem, as you're describing it, is a marketing problem, not a political problem. It's not an ideological problem. It's not a serious political argument.
But is a marketing problem not a political problem?
Yeah.
It can certainly be. I think in the politics we're talking about, it's the substance.
Well, there we are. On that note, we'll leave it. That was fun. Gavin McFadden and Xenia Dormady, thank you both as ever. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Where you London? This is Monocle 24.
London, du har Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
So that was the first half. The second half's rather good too. We're going to be in Alabama, we're going to be talking about China, and we're also going to be in Caracas, and I promise you some new music. Oh yes. But before all that, here's David Spencer with the latest news headlines for around the world.
Thank you very much indeed. Malaysia's military says it has traced what could have been the Boeing 777 that's been missing for almost 5 days. After contradictory statements, the military now says a plane was tracked to an area south of the Thai holiday island of Phuket, hundreds of miles from its last known position. But authorities remain no closer to discovering what happened to the Malaysia Airlines flight with 239 people on board. There have been clashes between police and protesters in Turkey as the funeral took place of a teenager injured in clashes last summer. Berkin Elvan died on Tuesday after spending 9 months in a coma. In Istanbul, tens of thousands of mourners marched through the streets as the teenager's funeral took place. Two people have died in a building collapse in New York City. At least 18 people have also been injured in the incident, which happened in Upper Manhattan. Ukraine's interim prime minister is to hold talks with President Obama in Washington. Arseniy Yatsenyuk will also speak at the United Nations. Six people have been killed after an air ambulance crashed in Colombia. The cause of the crash, 100 kilometres from Bogota, remains under investigation. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has authorised a forensic audit of the National Energy Company after weeks of public uproar over claims that the company failed to pay $20 billion to the government. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
David Spencer, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House as we head into the second half of the show. And it's time to check in with a Monocle correspondent. And today we're heading to Alabama, to Montgomery, Alabama, to be precise, to speak to our southern US correspondent, Barrett Austin. Barrett, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you very much, Steve. Good to be with you.
So we're going to be talking in a moment about South by Southwest, which you've been regaling us with tales all week about South by Southwest. But first, a little bit more of a serious story to begin with. President Obama he's been in his second term, or certainly in this part of his second term, he's been using executive order rather a lot, hasn't he, in terms of trying to avoid going to a Congress which frankly doesn't like him. And his newest attempt to bypass Congress is over overtime pay. Tell us more, Barrett Austin.
Well, as we all know, President Obama has been working very hard in his second term to address the issue of income inequality. Unfortunately, as you've just alluded to, taking these issues before the Republicans in Congress, he's found very little success. Dealing with issues like minimum wage laws in the country, Republicans are just not willing to debate this. At the core of this issue is an effort to expand the number of Americans who qualify for overtime pay. In the U.S., you have a number of people who are contractually obligated to work 40 hours a week, but for a number of legal reasons, they're exempt from any sort of overtime pay. So what President Obama is attempting to do here is take a lot of these employees who are hired and think perhaps they're going to be working 40 hours a week, but in many cases they're working 50, 60, 70 hours a week in a supervisory role, but not getting any sort of compensation for it.
So in terms of how many people this will affect, because he's not going through Congress, does that mean that actually, you know, his efforts to improve overtime pay mean it won't affect as many people?
I think just right off the bat, you're looking at several million people who will end up benefiting from this. At the moment, people who are earning $455 a week or less are exempt from this. So anyone who earns less than $455 a week is guaranteed overtime pay. In the U.S., that's typically time and a half. So if you're making $10 an hour, all the hours that you work overtime would be 15. President Obama has not come out and said exactly what the new cap would be, but a lot of people are speculating that it would be roughly twice as much. So in other words, people who are earning roughly $1,000 a month or $900 a month, they would now be exempt from this. And if they were earning in that bracket, they would now be earning time and a half.
Now, as you say, Republicans have been opposed to this. Why have they been? For them, do they just see it as an extra cost on businesses that simply can't afford it?
I think that's exactly what it is. I mean, unsurprisingly, Republicans have for years now opposed any sort of distortion in the labor markets. I think that, you know, in many cases, Republicans do play a very big role in representing the business community here. If you look at how people are responding to this, Republicans in Congress, they have a lot to say about this. They look at it from the standpoint of executive order and say perhaps there's not a whole lot that we can do, but from a grassroots level, it's something that they're going to be outspoken against over the next couple of weeks. You see conservative political action groups, groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who are standing firm in their opposition to this. Industry, for instance, is not happy with this. I think we're going to see business lobbyists very, very busy on Capitol Hill for the next couple of weeks doing what they can to oppose this. With this being an executive order, President Obama, of course, presents this to the Labor Department, and there's a public comment period that follows. So depending on what sort of reaction Americans come to the president with this and come before the Labor Department and come before Congress, there's a chance that he can dial this back a little bit. But yes, generally, Republicans view this as a distortion in the market. They think that If companies are compelled to pay their employers higher wages, what this means is that the employees will either reduce wages generally or hire fewer workers. Democrats, on the other hand, have come out saying that if this happens, if anything, companies will feel compelled to hire more employees because the employees that they have on the books right now who would be working overtime, they would cost more to have on staff. So if anything, companies would be hiring more employees, which, you know, generally is a very good thing.
Barrett, let's head a little bit to the west of where you are right now, a couple of states over from Alabama, over in Texas, in Austin, Texas. The South by Southwest Festival has been going on these past few days. It's a festival that's changed somewhat since its launch in the mid-late 80s. What are the key things that you've noticed in this year's incarnation that have been worth keeping an eye on?
Well, I think, generally speaking, South by Southwest launched in 1987, and it was a grassroots music festival. It was sort of an alternative to some of the other things that were going on there at the time. It's grown tremendously over the years. In 1994, they introduced the Interactive Technology Festival. There's now a relatively high-profile film festival. And one of the things that we've really noticed over the past 2 or 3 years is the increasing role that the big brands play from a marketing standpoint. I think that there are a number of brands like Doritos, Apple, Chevrolet, who have tremendous advertising and marketing budgets, and they're really spending this year to put on some really special performances.
You mentioned those brands. Given that it started off as quite an independent festival, are there some who find the arrival of big brands a little difficult to deal with?
I think so. I mean, if you look at festivals like this, particularly ones that are headlined with a music aspect, you're going to find people complain about any and every festival when there's too much corporate influence. I think this year, you're seeing brands like Doritos, they've sponsored a free concert by Lady Gaga. You see Apple is promoting the iTunes Music Festival, and they're putting on free concerts from bands like Coldplay and Pitbull. You see all of this blue chip talent that is being flaunted around the festival. And at its core, there are a lot of people who come to it and say, no, no, this is not what we want. We want to come to this and experience good local musicians, good national talents that we otherwise wouldn't have discovered. So I think there are definitely some people in the market of this who are saying it's becoming too corporate. There are even some startups who have traditionally come over the past, you know, say 5 to 10 years, who are saying they're not even interested in coming this year. They're just going to stay in Silicon Valley and keep working because it's simply not what it used to be for that reason.
Barrett Austin in Montgomery, Alabama. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. Still to come. Oh, lots still to come, including we'll be in Caracas. All that after this.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks, it's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hippi, for the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
The Monocle subscription package is your year-round entry into the world of Monocle. For £90, you get a year of Monocle in print, and that's 10 magazines, including two double issues and our two seasonal newspapers, Alpino and Mediterraneo. You'll get access to online archives and an exclusive tote bag designed by our in-house team and made by our friends at Rutote of Japan. Plus, free shipping to wherever you are in the world. And that's all for £90 sterling. Or you can double your fun with our two-year package for £170, which comes with two bags and our exclusive organiser. So treat yourself, or even a loved one, to a Monocle subscription, available at monocle.com.
And you're back with Midori House at 1842 now here in London, 1442 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. For the past 7 years, documentary photographer Joe Farrell has been documenting the lives of the last remaining women with bound feet in China. The tradition of binding feet used to be a way to display status in China. High society women could afford not to work, hence they could apply painfully tight binding to their daughters' feet to prevent further growth. Now the practice has been banned, and Weir's work captures the stories of the last women who've endured the pain of foot binding while being forced to work on the fields after the Cultural Revolution. And Joe Farrell joins us in the studio now. Joe, welcome to Midori House.
Ah, good afternoon. Evening.
Now it was quite a tradition, wasn't it? Before we talk about why it stopped, take us back to when it was first used and the reasons behind it.
There's a couple of stories or tales behind why foot binding started. It was the first one was in the Shang Dynasty, which was 1520 BC, which they said that there was a shape-shifting fox that came along in the shape of a woman, but they could not conceal the fox feet, so they covered them in binding. And the Emperor Wang at the time, he thought this was so dainty and beautiful that he got them to dance for them on lotus leaves, which is why they typically are called like golden lotus. In the courts, the concubines would also practiced like binding their feet because they knew the emperor liked it. There's other tales of in the Tang Dynasty that this happened as well with another of the emperors, that they brought along somebody who had such dainty feet and would dance on golden lotuses. So it became the courtesans and the concubines would wrap their feet to attract a partner to look more beautiful.
And talk us through the damage that it did to women's feet. Because it's, when you look at the pictures, it's, of the feet now, they look, gnarled and misshapen. And it looks like it wasn't the most pain-free experience.
It was a very painful experience, but it was typically done by the mother because they knew that they could give a better life to their daughter by doing this. And it involved... they wouldn't actually happen until they were 9, 10, 11 years old because the foot had to actually grow. A child's foot doesn't fully develop until that time. So they would, when they were able to bind them, they would push the small toes underneath and leave the big toe out. They would then put them in little shoes and take them different times, would... change the shoes so the shoes were smaller, making the foot smaller and smaller and smaller, so they would never be able to unbind them and the toes would break underneath.
And now you've been documenting these women for a number of years. How willing were they to open up and share with you not just their bodies but their feet but their stories?
I've photographed now over 50 women and interviewed them. I have about 50 questions I typically answer. So it's more of like an anthropological study and finding out more information from them. And I have a translator to help me because some of these questions are difficult, especially with the local dialects, to explain. These women are very old, so some of the questions they don't typically understand. They will quite often say that they can't remember that they're old, they're in the 80s or 90s, they have hearing problems, they don't understand the dialect of the translator. So they will tell some stories, but it's the culture of China is that, especially growing up in the Cultural Revolution, is that you don't have your own personal story. And so they don't necessarily think that they can tell you a lot of information.
And then just finally, the work that you've produced, it's actually going to go up in Hong Kong later next month. Talk to us just briefly about the reaction you've had from, particularly from Chinese women to this work.
I explained to them, in China, they don't quite understand why I want to photograph this and what is the information about it. And I'm lucky that, A, as a woman, that they are much more open to me photographing their feet. I explained to them it's more of an academic portraiture documentation of their lives, as no one else is really doing this kind of project.
Jo Farrell, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much indeed for coming in and sharing your work with us. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be in Caracas in a moment, but taking us there, this is new from Elbow. It's New York Morning.
First to put a simple truth in words binds the world in a feeling all familiar, 'cause everybody owns the great ideas and it feels like there's a big one round the corner.
Montana open out into New York.
At the wonderful New York Morning there by Elbow from their new album, The Takeoff and Landing of Everything. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. You should know that by now, you know, you've been 51 minutes, hasn't it? It's time now for our weekly television review. And today we thought we'd turn to Venezuela, where anti-government protesters have been demonstrating for a month today, for a look at the country's rather unique political shows. A little earlier, our Caracas contributor, Irene Caselli, told Averio and Daphne Denis what she should look out for on state television and elsewhere.
Aló, presidente, bravo, el aló, presidente, el jueves por la noche.
The Lo Presidente was broadcast every Sunday, and it could last for hours and hours. It started in 1999 when Hugo Chavez came to power, and it went on until he disappeared from public life in 2012 because of his cancer. There's a total of about 1,600 hours of broadcasting, and during those hours, Mr. Chavez would tell citizens about what the cabinet was up to, but he would also sing and dance, he would recite poetry, he would invite foreign guests to talk, and even tell anecdotes. One very famous episode is when Chavez actually talks of having a severe urge to go to the bathroom. And this episode is very famous. And the best of that program is still broadcast on public television once a week.
So what's the reaction to that show? I mean, how entertaining was it?
It was incredibly entertaining. Mr. Chavez was a natural entertainer, according to many, and he had a flair for this. It wasn't just about politics. It was a lot about him, about his personality. And you could find out a lot of things. He would read out excerpts from books. And loads of people have actually told me here in Venezuela that they learned a lot by listening to the president every weekend.
How transparent was that show? You were saying that he would give an update on the state of the nation and what he'd been up to. How much did he reveal of his politics?
Well, it was very transparent in the sense that you would actually hear announcements regarding the government live on television. So, you know, if he had to expel foreign dignitaries or he had to announce some important changes in the cabinet, that was done on live television. Of course, there is a level of transparency that is not part of what the Venezuelan government does. So, for example, figures on murder rates at some point stopped being available, and of course they were not discussed on public television. But what was for sure was that it started a new trend, not only within Venezuela, but also region-wide. Let's not forget that within the whole region, presidents, for example, Rafael Correa in Ecuador or Evo Morales in Bolivia, they use what are called cadenas nacionales. These are public compulsory broadcasts that have to be carried out by all radio and TV channels. And now those are used regularly by all these presidents, including Nicolas Maduro, in order to make public announcements.
Let's move on then to what's happened with Nicolas Maduro now. What's he doing with television? He doesn't have a show for himself, does he?
He just started actually his own radio show, which started this week. It's called En Contacto con Maduro, so In Contact with Maduro. But the first show, which was broadcast on Tuesday, was also broadcast on national TV. And it was actually a strange affair because the president was wearing headphones in a DJ style, and he was picking songs and playing songs while speaking about the country's political situation. It has a very different flair from what we could see in Allo Presidente. This show, he said, was a tribute to Chavez, and strangely enough, it came just a few weeks after rival politician Diosdado Cabello, who's from his own party and is a very powerful figure, also launched his own TV program that was also dedicated to Hugo Chavez.
That's quite interesting because Diosdado Cabello, he's been described in the US, for those who watch House of Cards, as the Frank Underwood of Venezuelan politics. He's someone that's always been present in the sort of political sphere, but he's kind of a contender for Maduro, isn't he?
That's right. Diosdado Cabello was one of the possible successors of Hugo Chavez. He's a famous politician, he's powerful, he's a former military officer just like Hugo Chavez, and he's currently the head of the assembly. He's part of a different faction within Hugo Chavez's party, within the government party, and there's a lot of bickering apparently behind doors between Maduro and Cabello. So Mr. Cabello's TV show is very different from Maduro's. It's called Con el Mazo Dando, which is part of a saying that means God helps those who help themselves. During the first show, his daughter Daniela dedicated a song to Hugo Chavez called Gotas de Lluvia, Drops of Rain.
Me entristece a veces no volverte a ver. Y es que pienso entonces lo aprendido, que sigo tus pasos, tus pasos.
That's kind of personal. He's sort of taken a very personal stance on his relationship with Chavez on this show, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. During his first program, he explained how important it was to have a TV program to sort of continue in the footsteps of Hugo Chavez. And also because of his him being a retired military officer, he almost put himself forward as a worthy successor of Hugo Chavez in that sense, because of the military strategy that comes with his own political style.
And finally, Dene, which show did you prefer of all of those that you've been talking about?
Well, I felt that Mr. Cabello's show can tell you a lot about what's happening politically in the country. To me, right now, it seems that that's the most crucial one to watch.
That was Irene Caselli, a woman in Venezuela, talking to Daphne Dini. And that's all we've got time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Zania Dormandy and Gavin McFadyen. The show was produced by Daphne Dini, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christy Roma. Our studio manager was Sean Malervi. The Entrepreneurs is up next this week with Daniel Giacopelli. The Monocle Daily is a little bit later, 2200 hours. And of course, Midori House, we're back at the same time tomorrow. It's 1800 hours London time, 1400 hours if you're on the East Coast. My name's Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.